In our next story, The Cafeteria, we leave Europe far behind, but not in the memories of the Yiddish-speaking immigrants who passed their days in a modest dairy restaurant in midtown Manhattan in the 1950s. The author, Isaac Bashevis Singer, is famous for stories in which the lines between past and present, natural and supernatural, are often blurred. His characters are ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. In this story, written after the Holocaust, Singer's characters experience an everyday reality that is inseparable from all that has happened before. And now, The Cafeteria by Isaac Bashevis Singer. Our reader is David Margulies.
Even though I've reached the point where a great part of my earnings is given away in taxes, I still have the habit of eating in cafeterias when I'm by myself. I like to take a tray with a tin knife, fork, spoon, and paper napkin, and to choose at the counter the food I enjoy. Besides, I meet there the Landsleute from Poland, as well as all kinds of literary beginners and readers who know Yiddish. The moment I sit down at the table, they come over. "Hello, Aaron," they greet me. And we talk about Yiddish literature, the Holocaust, the State of Israel, and often about acquaintances who were eating rice pudding or stewed prunes the last time I was here, and are already in their graves. Since I seldom read a paper, I learn this news only later. Each time I'm startled, but at my age one has to be ready for such tidings. The food sticks in the throat, we look at one another in confusion, and our eyes ask mutely, "Whose turn is next?" Soon we begin to chew again. I'm often reminded of a scene in a film about Africa. A lion attacks a herd of zebras and kills one. The frightened zebras run for a while, and then they stop and start to graze again. Do they have a choice? I cannot spend too long with these Yiddishists, because I'm always busy. I'm writing a novel, a story, an article. I have to lecture today or tomorrow. My date book is crowded with all kinds of appointments for weeks and months in advance. It can happen that an hour after I leave the cafeteria, I'm on a train to Chicago or flying to California. But meanwhile, we converse in the mother language, and I hear of intrigues and pettiness about which, from a moral point of view, it would be better not to be informed. Everyone tries in his own way, with all his means, to grab as many honors and as much money and prestige as he can. None of us learns from all these deaths. Old age does not cleanse us. We don't repent at the gate of hell. I've been moving around in this neighborhood for over 30 years, as long as I lived in Poland. I know each block, each house. There has been little building here on Uptown Broadway in the last decades, and I have the illusion of having put down roots here. I've spoken in most of the synagogues. They know me in some of the stores and in the vegetarian restaurants. Women with whom I have had affairs live on the side streets. Even the pigeons know me. The moment I come out with a bag of feed, they begin to fly toward me from blocks away. It is an area that stretches from 96th Street to 72nd Street and from Central Park to Riverside Drive. Almost every day, on my walk after lunch, I pass the funeral parlor that waits for us and all our ambitions and illusions. Sometimes I imagine that the funeral parlor is also a kind of cafeteria, where one gets a quick eulogy or kaddish on the way to eternity. The cafeteria people I meet are mostly men, old bachelors like myself, would-be writers, retired teachers, some with dubious doctorate titles, a rabbi without a congregation, a painter of Jewish themes, a few translators, all immigrants from Poland or Russia. I seldom know their names. One of them disappears, and I think he is already in the next world. Suddenly he reappears, and he tells me that he has tried to settle in Tel Aviv or Los Angeles. Again, he eats his rice pudding, sweetens his coffee with saccharin. He has a few more wrinkles, But he tells the same stories and makes the same gestures. It may happen that he takes a paper from his pocket and reads me a poem he has written. It was in the 50s that a woman appeared in the group who looked younger than the rest of us. She must have been in her early 30s. She was short, slim, with a girlish face, brown hair that she wore in a bun, a short nose, and dimples in her cheeks. Her eyes were hazel, actually of an indefinite color. She dressed in a modest European way. She spoke Polish, Russian, and an idiomatic Yiddish. She always carried Yiddish newspapers and magazines. She had been in a prison camp in Russia and had spent some time in the camps in Germany before she obtained a visa for the United States. The men all hovered around her. They didn't let her pay the check. They gallantly brought her coffee and cheesecake. They listened to her talk and joke. She had returned from the devastation, still gay. She was introduced to me. Her name was Esther. I didn't know if she was unmarried, a widow, a divorcee. She told me she was working in a factory where she sorted buttons. This fresh young woman did not fit into the group of elderly has-beens. It was also hard to understand why she couldn't find a better job than sorting buttons in New Jersey. But I didn't ask too many questions. She told me that she had read my writing while still in Poland and later in the camps in Germany after the war. She said to me, "You are my writer." The moment she uttered those words, I imagined I was in love with her. We were sitting alone. The other man at our table had gone to make a telephone call, and I said, "For such words, I must kiss you." "Well, what are you waiting for?" She gave me both a kiss and a bite. I said, "You are a ball of fire." "Yes, fire from Gehenna." A few days later, she invited me to her home. She lived on a street between Broadway and Riverside Drive with her father, who had no legs and sat in a wheelchair. His legs had been frozen in Siberia. He had tried to run away from one of Stalin's slave camps in the winter of 1944. He looked like a strong man, had a head of thick white hair, a ruddy face, and eyes full of energy. He spoke in a swaggering fashion, with boyish boastfulness and a cheerful laugh. In an hour, he told me a story. He was born in White Russia, but he had lived long years in Warsaw, Lodz, and Vilna. In the beginning of the 30s, he became a communist, and soon afterward a functionary in the party. In 1939, he escaped to Russia with his daughter. His wife and the other children remained in Nazi-occupied Warsaw. In Russia, someone denounced him as a Trotskyite, and he was sent to mine gold in the north. The GPU sent people there to die. Even the strongest could not survive the cold and hunger for more than a year. They were exiled without a sentence. They died together. Zionists, Bundists, members of the Polish Socialist Party, Ukrainian nationalists, and just refugees, all caught because of the labor shortage. They often died of scurvy or beriberi. Boris Mirkin, Esther's father, spoke about this as if it were a big joke. He called the Stalinists outcasts, bandits, sycophants. He assured me that had it not been for the United States, Hitler would have overrun all of Russia. He told how prisoners tricked the guards to get an extra piece of bread or a double portion of watery soup, and what methods were used in picking lice. Esther called out, "Father, enough." "What's the matter? Am I lying?" "One can have enough, even of kreplach." "Daughter, you did it yourself." When Esther went to the kitchen to make tea, I learned from her father that she had had a husband in Russia, a Polish Jew who had volunteered in the Red Army and perished in the war. Here in New York, she was courted by a refugee, a former smuggler in Germany who had opened a bookbinding factory and become rich. "Persuaded to marry him," Boris Mirkin said to me. "It would be good for me, too." "Maybe she doesn't love him." "There's no such thing as love. Give me a cigarette." In the camp, people climbed on one another like worms. I had invited Esther to supper, but she called to say she had the grip and must remain in bed. Then in a few days' time, a situation arose that made me leave for Israel. On the way back, I stopped over in London and Paris. I wanted to write to Esther, but I'd lost her address. When I returned to New York, I tried to call her, but there was no telephone listing for Boris Mirkin or Esther Mirkin. Father and daughter must have been boarders in somebody else's apartment. Weeks passed, and she did not show up in the cafeteria. I asked a group about her. Nobody knew where she was. She has most probably married that bookbinder, I said to myself. One evening, I went to the cafeteria with the premonition that I would find Esther there. I saw a black wall and boarded windows. The cafeteria had burned. The old bachelors were no doubt meeting in another cafeteria or an automat, but where? To search is not in my nature. I had plenty of complications without Esther. The summer passed. It was winter. Late one day, I walked by the cafeteria and again saw lights, a counter, guests. The owners had rebuilt. I entered, took a check, and saw Esther sitting alone at a table reading a Yiddish newspaper. She did not notice me, and I observed her for a while. She wore a man's fur fez and a jacket trimmed with a faded fur collar. She looked pale, as though recuperating from a sickness. Could that grip have been the start of a serious illness? I went over to her table and asked, "What's new in Buttons?" She started and smiled. Then she called out, "Miracles do happen." "Where have you been?" "Where did you disappear to?" she replied. "I thought you were still abroad." "Where are our cafeteria nicks?" "They now go to the cafeteria on 57th and 8th Avenue. They only reopened this place yesterday." "May I bring you a cup of coffee?" "I drink too much coffee." "All right." I went to get a coffee and a large egg cookie. While I stood at the counter, I turned my head and looked at her. Esther had taken off her mannish fur hat and smoothed her hair. She folded the newspaper, which meant that she was ready to talk. She got up and tilted the other chair against the table as a sign that the seat was taken. When I sat down, Esther said, "You left without saying goodbye, and there I was about to knock at the pearly gates of heaven." "What happened?" "Oh, the grip became pneumonia. They gave me penicillin, and I am one of those who cannot take it. I got a rash all over my body. My father, too, is not well." "What's the matter with your father?" "High blood pressure. He had a kind of stroke, and his mouth became all crooked." "Oh, I'm sorry. Do you still work with Buttons?" "Yes, with Buttons. At least I don't have to use my head, only my hands. I can think my own thoughts." "What do you think about?" "What not? The other workers are all Puerto Ricans. They rattle away in Spanish from morning to night."
"Who takes care of your father?"
"Who? Nobody. I come home in the evening to make supper. He has one desire, to marry me off for my own good and perhaps for his comfort. But I can't marry a man I don't love."
"What is love?"
"You ask me. You write novels about it, but you're a man. I assume you really don't know what it is. A woman is a piece of merchandise to you. To me, a man who talks nonsense or smiles like an idiot is repulsive. I would rather die than live with him. And a man who goes from one woman to another is not for me. I don't want to share with anybody."
"I'm afraid a time is coming when everybody will."
"That's not for me."
"What kind of person was your husband?"
"How did you know I had a husband?" "My father, I suppose. The minute I leave the room, he prattles." "My husband believed in things and was ready to die for them. He was not exactly my type, but I respected him and loved him, too. He wanted to die, and he died like a hero. What else can I say?"
"And the others?"
"There were no others. Men were after me. The way people behaved in the war, you will never know. They lost all shame. On the bunks near me one time, a mother lay with one man and a daughter with another. People were like beasts, worse than beasts. In the middle of it all, I dreamed about love. Now I've even stopped dreaming. The men who come here are terrible bores. Most of them are half mad, too. One of them tried to read me a 40-page poem. I almost fainted."
"I wouldn't read you anything I'd written."
"I've been told how you behave. No."
"No is no. Drink your coffee."
"You don't even try to persuade me. Most men around here plague you, and you can't get rid of them. In Russia, people suffered, but I've never met as many maniacs there as in New York City. The building where I live is a madhouse. My neighbors are lunatics. They accuse each other of all kinds of things. They sing, cry, break dishes. One of them jumped out of the window and killed herself. She was having an affair with a boy 20 years younger. In Russia, the problem was to escape the lice. Here, you're surrounded by insanity."
We drank coffee and shared the egg cookie.
Esther put down her cup.
I can't believe that I'm sitting with you at this table. I read all your articles under all your pen names. You tell so much about yourself. I have the feeling I've known you for years. Still, you are a riddle to me.
Men and women can never understand one another.
No, I cannot understand my own father. Sometimes he's a complete stranger to me. He won't live long.
Is he so sick?
It's everything together. He's lost the will to live. Why live without legs, without friends, without a family? They've all perished. He sits and reads the newspapers all day long. He acts as though he were interested in what's going on in the world. His ideals are gone, but he still hopes for a just revolution. How can a revolution help him? I myself never put my hopes in any movement or party. How can we hope when everything ends in death?
Hope in itself is a proof that there is no death.
Yes, I know you often write about this. For me, death is the only comfort. What do the dead do? They continue to drink coffee and eat egg cookies? They still read newspapers? A life after death would be nothing but a joke.
Some of the cafeterianics came back to the rebuilt cafeteria. New people appeared, all of them Europeans. They launched into long discussions in Yiddish, Polish, Russian, even Hebrew. Some of those who came from Hungary mixed German, Hungarian, Yiddish, German. Then all of a sudden they began to speak plain Galician Yiddish. They asked to have their coffee in glasses and held lumps of sugar between their teeth when they drank. Many of them were my readers. They introduced themselves and reproached me for all kinds of literary errors. I contradicted myself. Went too far in descriptions of sex, described Jews in such a way that anti-Semites could use it for propaganda. They told me their experiences in the ghettos, in the Nazi concentration camps in Russia. They pointed out one another. Do you see that fellow? In Russia, he immediately became a Stalinist. He denounced his own friends. Here in America, he switched to anti-Bolshevism. The one who was spoken about seemed to sense that he was being maligned, because the moment my informant left, he took his cup of coffee and his rice pudding, sat down at my table and said, "Don't believe a word of what you're told. They invent all kinds of lies. What could you do in a country where the rope was always around your neck? You had to adjust yourself if you wanted to live and not die somewhere in Kazakhstan. To get a bowl of soup or a place to stay, you had to sell your soul." There was a table with a group of refugees who ignored me. They were not interested in literature and journalism, but strictly in business. In Germany, they'd been smugglers. They seemed to be doing shady business here, too. They whispered to one another and winked, counted their money, wrote long lists of numbers. Somebody pointed out one of them. He had a store in Auschwitz.
What do you mean, a store?
God help us. He kept his merchandise in the straw where he slept. A rotten potato, sometimes a piece of soap, a tin spoon, a little fat. Still, he did business. Later in Germany, he became such a big smuggler, they once took $40,000 away from him. Sometimes, months passed between my visits to the cafeteria. A year or two had gone by, perhaps three or four. I lost count, and Esther did not show up. I asked about her a few times. Someone said that she was going to the cafeteria on 42nd Street. Another had heard that she was married. I learned that some of the cafeterianics had died. They were beginning to settle down in the United States, had remarried, opened businesses, workshops, even had children again. Then came cancer or a heart attack, the result of the Hitler and Stalin years, it was said. One day, I entered the cafeteria and saw Esther. She was sitting alone at a table. It was the same Esther. She was even wearing the same fur hat. But a strand of gray hair fell over her forehead. How strange, the fur hat too seemed to have grayed. The other cafeterianics did not appear to be interested in her anymore, or they did not know her. Her face told of the time that had passed. There were shadows under her eyes. Her gaze was no longer so clear. Around her mouth was an expression that could be called bitterness, disenchantment. I greeted her. She smiled. But her smile immediately faded away. I asked, "What happened to you?" "Oh, I'm still alive. May I sit down?"
"Please, certainly."
"May I bring you a cup of coffee?"
"No."
"Well, if you insist."
I noticed that she was smoking, and also that she was reading not the newspaper to which I contribute, but a competition paper. She had gone over to the enemy. I brought her coffee, and for myself stewed prunes, a remedy for constipation. I sat down. Where were you all this time? I've asked for you. Really? Thank you. What happened? Nothing good. She looked at me. I knew that she saw in me what I saw in her, the slow wilting of the flesh. She said, "You have no hair, but you are white." For a while we were silent. Then I said, "Your father?" And as I said it, I knew that her father was not alive. Esther said, "He has been dead for almost a year." "Do you still sort buttons?" "No. I became an operator in a dress shop." "What happened to you personally, may I ask?" "Oh, nothing. Absolutely nothing. You will not believe it, but I was sitting here thinking about you. I have fallen into some kind of trap. I don't know what to call it. I thought perhaps you could advise me. Do you still have the patience to listen to the troubles of little people like me?" "I didn't mean to insult you. I even doubted you would remember me. To make it short, I work, but work is growing more difficult for me. I suffer from arthritis. I feel as if my bones would crack. I wake up in the morning and can't sit up. One doctor tells me that it's a disc in my back. Others try to cure my nerves. One took x-rays and says that I have a tumor. He wanted me to go to a hospital for a few weeks, but I'm in no hurry for an operation." Suddenly, a little lawyer showed up. He is a refugee himself and is connected with the German government. "You know they're now giving reparation money? It's true that I escaped to Russia, but I'm a victim of the Nazis just the same. Besides, they don't know my biography so exactly. I could get a pension plus a few $1,000s, but my dislocated disc is no good for the purpose because I got it later, after the camps. This lawyer says my only chance is to convince them that I am ruined psychically. It's the bitter truth, but how can you prove it? The German doctors, the neurologists, the psychiatrists require proof. Everything has to be according to the textbooks, just so and no different. The lawyer wants me to play insane. Naturally, he gets 20% of the reparation money, maybe more. Why he needs so much money, I don't understand. He's already in his 70s, an old bachelor. He tried to make love to me and whatnot. He's half Meshuggah himself. But how can I play insane when actually I am insane? The whole thing revolts me, and I'm afraid it will really drive me crazy. I hate swindle. But this shyster pursues me. I don't sleep. When the alarm rings in the morning, I wake up as shattered as I used to be in Russia when I had to walk to the forest and saw logs at 4 in the morning. Naturally, I take sleeping pills. If I didn't, I couldn't sleep at all. That is more or less the situation. Why don't you get married? You're still a good-looking woman. Well, the old question. There is nobody. It's too late. If you knew how I felt, you wouldn't ask such a question. A few weeks passed. Snow had been falling. After the snow came rain, then frost. I stood at my window and looked out at Broadway. The passers-by half walked, half slipped. Cars moved slowly. The sky above the roofs shone violet, without a moon, without stars. And even though it was 8 o'clock in the evening, the light and the emptiness reminded me of dawn. The stores were deserted. For a moment I had the feeling I was in Warsaw. The telephone rang, and I rushed to answer it as I did 10, 20, 30 years ago, still expecting the good tidings that a telephone call was about to bring me. I said hello, but there was no answer, and I was seized by the fear that some evil power was trying to keep back the good news at the last minute. Then I heard a stammering. A woman's voice muttered my name. "Yes, it is I." "Excuse me for disturbing you. My name is Esther. We met a few weeks ago in the cafeteria." "Esther!" I exclaimed. "I don't know how I got the courage to phone you. I need to talk to you about something. Naturally, if you have the time. And please forgive my presumption." "No presumption. Would you like to come to my apartment?" "If I will not be interrupting. It's difficult to talk in the cafeteria. It's noisy, and there are eavesdroppers. What I want to tell you is a secret. I wouldn't trust anyone else. Please, come up." I gave Esther directions. Then I tried to make order in my apartment, but I soon realized this was impossible.
Letters, manuscripts lay around on tables and chairs. In the corners, books and magazines were piled high. I opened the closets and threw inside whatever was under my hand. Jackets, pants, shirts, shoes, slippers. I picked up an envelope and to my amazement saw that it had never been opened. I tore it open and found a check. "What's the matter with me? Have I lost my mind?" I said out loud. I tried to read the letter that came with the check, but I had misplaced my glasses. My fountain pen was gone, too. Well, and where were my keys? I heard a bell ring, and I didn't know whether it was the door or the telephone. I opened the door and saw Esther. It must have been snowing again, because her hat and the shoulders of her coat were trimmed with white. I asked her in, and my neighbor, the divorcee, who spied on me openly with no shame and, God knows, with no sense of purpose, opened her door and stared at my guest. Esther removed her boots, and I took her coat and put it on the case of the Encyclopedia Britannica. I shoved a few manuscripts off the sofa so she could sit down. I said, "In my house there is sheer chaos. It doesn't matter." I sat in an armchair strewn with socks and handkerchiefs. For a while we spoke about the weather, about the danger of being out in New York at night, even early in the evening. Then Esther said, "Do you remember the time I spoke to you about my lawyer, that I had to go to a psychiatrist because of the reparation money?" "Yes, I remember." "I didn't tell you everything. It was too wild. It still seems unbelievable, even to me. Don't interrupt me, I implore you. I'm not completely healthy. I may even say that I'm sick. But I know the difference between fact and illusion. I haven't slept for nights, and I kept wondering whether I should call you or not. I decided not to, but this evening it occurred to me that if I couldn't trust you with a thing like this, then there is no one I could talk to. I read you, and I know that you have a sense of the great mysteries." Esther said all this stammering and with pauses. For a moment her eyes smiled, and then they became sad and wavering. I said, "You can tell me everything. I'm afraid that you'll think me insane." "I swear I will not." Esther bit her lower lip. "I want you to know that I saw Hitler," she said. Even though I was prepared for something unusual, my throat constricted. "When? Where?" "You see, you're frightened already. It happened 3 years ago, almost 4. I saw him here on Broadway." "On the street?" "In the cafeteria." I tried to swallow the lump in my throat. "Most probably someone resembling him," I said finally. "I knew you would say that. But remember, you promised to listen. You recall the fire in the cafeteria?" "Yes, certainly." "The fire has to do with it. Since you don't believe me anyhow, why draw it out?" "It happened this way. That night I didn't sleep. Usually when I can't sleep, I get up and make tea or I try to read a book. But this time some power commanded me to get dressed and go out. I can't explain to you how I dared walk on Broadway at that late hour. It must have been 2 or 3 o'clock. I reached the cafeteria, thinking perhaps it stays open all night. I tried to look in, but the large window was covered by a curtain. There was a pale glow inside. I tried the revolving door and it turned. I went in and saw a scene I will not forget till the last day of my life. The tables were shoved together, and around them sat men in white robes, like doctors or orderlies, all with swastikas on their sleeves. At the head sat Hitler. I beg you to hear me out. Even a deranged person sometimes deserves to be listened to. They all spoke German. They didn't see me. They were busy with the Führer. It grew quiet, and he started to talk. That abominable voice, I heard it many times on the radio. I didn't make out exactly what he said. I was too terrified to take it in. Suddenly, one of his henchmen looked back at me and jumped up from his chair. How I came out alive, I will never know. I ran with all my strength, and I was trembling all over. When I got home, I said to myself, "Esther, you are not right in the head." I still don't know how I lived through that night. The next morning, I didn't go straight to work, but walked to the cafeteria to see if it was really there. Such an experience makes a person doubt his own senses. When I arrived, I found the place had burned down. When I saw this, I knew it had to do with what I had seen. Those who were there wanted all traces erased. These are the plain facts. I have no reason to fabricate such queer things. We were both silent. Then I said, "You had a vision." "What do you mean, a vision?" "The past is not lost. An image from years ago remained present somewhere in the fourth dimension, and it reached you just at that moment.
As far as I know, Hitler never wore a long white robe. Perhaps he did.
Why did the cafeteria burn down just that night? Esther asked.
It could be that the fire evoked the vision.
There was no fire then. Somehow I foresaw that you would give me this kind of explanation. If this was a vision, my sitting here with you is also a vision.
It couldn't have been anything else. Even if Hitler is living and is hiding out in the United States, he's not likely to meet his cronies at a cafeteria on Broadway. Besides, the cafeteria belongs to a Jew.
I saw him as I am seeing you now.
You had a glimpse back in time.
Well, let it be so. But since then I have had no rest. I keep thinking about it. If I'm destined to lose my mind, this will drive me to it.
The telephone rang, and I jumped up with a start. It was a wrong number. I sat down again.
What about the psychiatrist your lawyer sent you to? Tell it to him, and you'll get full compensation.
Esther looked at me sidewise and unfriendly. I know what you mean. I haven't fallen that low yet.
I was afraid that Esther would continue to call me. I even planned to change my telephone number. But weeks and months passed, and I never heard from her or saw her. I didn't go to the cafeteria, but I often thought about her. How can the brain produce such nightmares? What goes on in that little marrow behind the skull? And what guarantee do I have that the same sort of thing will not happen to me? And how do we know that the human species will not end like this? I have played with the idea that all humanity suffers from schizophrenia. Along with the atom, the personality of Homo sapiens has been splitting. When it comes to technology, the brain still functions, but in everything else, degeneration has begun. They're all insane. The communists, the fascists, the preachers of democracy, the writers, the painters, the clergy, the atheists. Soon technology, too, will disintegrate. Buildings will collapse. Power plants will stop generating electricity. Generals will drop atomic bombs on their own populations. Mad revolutionaries will run in the streets, crying fantastic slogans. I've often thought that it would begin in New York. This metropolis has all the symptoms of a mind gone berserk. But since insanity has not yet taken over altogether, one has to act as though there were still order, according to Vaihinger's principle of as if. I continued with my scribbling. I delivered manuscripts to the publisher. I lectured. 4 times a year I sent checks to the federal government, the state. What was left after my expenses I put in the savings bank. A teller entered some numbers in my bank book, and this meant that I was provided for. Somebody printed a few lines in a magazine or newspaper, and this signified that my value as a writer had gone up. I saw with amazement that all my efforts turned into paper. My apartment was one big waste paper basket. From day to day, all this paper was getting drier and more parched. I woke up at night fearful that it would ignite. There was not an hour when I did not hear the sirens of fire engines. A year after I had last seen Esther, I was going to Toronto to read a paper about Yiddish in the second half of the 19th century. I put a few shirts in my valise, as well as papers of all kinds, among them one that made me a citizen of the United States. I had enough paper money in my pocket to pay for a taxi to Grand Central, but the taxis seemed to be taken. Those that were not refused to stop. Didn't the drivers see me? Had I suddenly become one of those who see and are not seen? I decided to take the subway. On my way, I saw Esther. She was not alone, but with someone I had known years ago, soon after I arrived in the United States. He was a frequenter of a cafeteria on East Broadway. He used to sit at a table, express opinions, criticize, grumble. He was a small man, with sunken cheeks the color of brick and bulging eyes. He was angry at the new writers. He belittled the old ones. He rolled his own cigarettes and dropped ashes into the plates from which we ate. Almost 2 decades had passed since I had last seen him. Suddenly he appears with Esther. He was even holding her arm.
I had never seen Esther look so well. She was wearing a new coat, a new hat. She smiled at me and nodded. I wanted to stop her, but my watch showed that it was late. I barely managed to catch the train. In my bedroom, the bed was already made. I undressed and went to sleep. In the middle of the night, I awoke. My car was being switched, and I almost fell out of bed. I could not sleep anymore, and I tried to remember the name of the little man I had seen with Esther, but I was unable to. The thing I did remember was that even 30 years ago he had been far from young. He had come to the United States in 1905, after the revolution in Russia. In Europe, he had a reputation as a speaker and public figure. How old must he be now? According to my calculations, he had to be in the late 80s, perhaps even 90. Is it possible that Esther could be intimate with such an old man? But this evening he had not looked old. The longer I brooded about it in the darkness, the stranger the encounter seemed to me. I even imagined that somewhere in a newspaper I had read that he had died. Do corpses walk around on Broadway? This would mean that Esther, too, was not living. I raised the window shade and sat up and looked out into the night, black, impenetrable, without a moon. A few stars ran along with the train for a while, and then they disappeared. A lighted factory emerged. I saw machines, but no operators. Then it was swallowed in the darkness, and another group of stars began to follow the train. I was turning with the earth on its axis. I was circling with it around the sun and moving in the direction of a constellation whose name I had forgotten. Is there no death? Or is there no life? I thought about what Esther had told me of seeing Hitler in the cafeteria. It had seemed utter nonsense, but now I began to reappraise the idea. If time and space are nothing more than forms of perception, as Kant argues, and quality, quantity, causality, are only categories of thinking, why shouldn't Hitler confer with his Nazis in a cafeteria on Broadway? Esther didn't sound insane. She had seen a piece of reality that the heavenly censorship prohibits as a rule. She had caught a glimpse behind the curtain of the phenomena. I regretted that I had not asked for more details. In Toronto, I had little time to ponder these matters, but when I returned to New York, I went to the cafeteria for some private investigation. I met only one man I knew, a rabbi who had become an agnostic and given up his job. I asked him about Esther. He said, "The pretty little woman who used to come here?" "Yes." "I heard that she committed suicide."
"When? How?"
"I don't know. Perhaps we are not speaking about the same person." No matter how many questions I asked and how much I described Esther, everything remained vague. Some young woman who used to come here had turned on the gas and made an end of herself. That was all the ex-rabbi could tell me. I decided not to rest until I knew for certain what had happened to Esther and also to that half-writer, half-politician I remembered from East Broadway. But I grew busier from day to day. The cafeteria closed. The neighborhood changed. Years have passed, and I've never seen Esther again. Yes, corpses do walk on Broadway. But why did Esther choose that particular corpse? She could have got a better bargain, even in this world.
That was The Cafeteria, written by Isaac Bashevis Singer and read by David Margolese. The translation by the author and Dorothea Strauss may be found in the Collected Stories of Isaac Bashevis Singer, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. And that concludes today's program of Jewish short stories from Eastern Europe and beyond, produced by the National Yiddish Book Center and public radio station KCRW Santa Monica. The series was directed by Joan Micklin-Silver and produced in the studios of KCRW by Laurie Alana McGlinchey and Johanna Cooper, with assistance from Roz Abraham. Original music was composed and arranged by Hank Osnetsky. Narration was written by Leonard Glick, Kenneth Turan, Aaron Lansky, and Laurie McGlinchey. Our engineers are Theo Mondel, Lechik Wojcik, and Jerry LaRosa. Music engineered by Steve Revelak and John Servies, with production assistance by George B. Hicks and Stefan Weibel. Sound mixing by Theo Mondel and Ray Guana. Our executive producers are Aaron Lansky and Ruth Seymour. The full 13-hour series of Jewish short stories from Eastern Europe and beyond is available on cassette from the National Yiddish Book Center. For information, please call 1-800-9-SERIES, 1-800-973-7437. Major funding for this series was provided by the Joseph S. and Diane Steinberg Charitable Trust of New York City. Additional support was provided by the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Dora Teitelbaum Foundation, the Lewis and Helen Padnos Foundation, the California Arts Council, the Joseph Meyerhoff Memorial Trusts, Irving and Trudy Lehrer, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the members and friends of KCRW and the National Yiddish Book Center. Support for the distribution of this program comes from National Public Radio member stations and National Public Radio, whose contributors include the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people make the arts part of their everyday lives. For KCRW and the National Yiddish Book Center, I'm Leonard Nimoy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.